So, Berto, emails, let's answer them. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and I'm a professor.
A professor. My name is Umberto Castañeda, and I swim upstream looking for just the right salmon.
So this email is from anonymous patron. He says, "Hello, I recently listened to your woman-on-woman sexual assault video and found it eye-opening. I was wondering if you could also talk about man-on-man sexual assault as well. A couple of years ago, one of my close friends admitted to me that he was assaulted by another man as an adult. The possibility had not even crossed my mind until he told me that something like that could happen. I feel especially terrible because I have literally laughed at those types of scenes in films and shows where male-on-male sexual assault is used as a punchline when I was younger. I still don't really understand why self-identified, quote-unquote, straight men would target other men in that way. I'm curious about your thoughts on it." Brutal?
Yeah. It comes to mind, Terry Crews in the last few years.
Yeah.
Where he came out and said, you know, that a person in the industry, kind of a powerful agent or something, had groped him inappropriately and that he felt completely dehumanized. And a lot of people made fun of him. Like, Terry Crews is this huge, buff dude. And he's like, "Come on, get over it, whatever. You're not at risk," or something. But a lot of people came out in support. Like, yeah. I have to say, the only exposure I've had, you know, like just like in media and stuff, is all the prison rapes and things that can happen. But I'm not as familiar with this phenomena, but I know it happens, and it's probably taboo to talk about with a lot of crowds, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So this absolutely happens often. The thing that I have learned over the years as a clinician and looking at the research is that sexual assault, sexual abuse, harassment is happening way more often than people realize commonly. And it's happening to everybody from everybody. We don't just look at women victims and male perpetrators. Are there higher rates of male perpetrators? Yes. Are there higher rates of women victims? Yes. But we're not talking like that the percentage of male victims is like 0.001%. We're talking like of all the victims, you're looking at, I don't know, 30, 40% of them would identify as a male. So it's all over the place. And so, of course, you're going to have a configuration where a straight man sexually assaults another straight man. It happens. And across the board, these kinds of assaults are not reported because of victim blame and a failure in the justice system and a failure of our society. And even if they do come forward, they get attacked, like Terry Crews, or it just gets swept under the rug. It's getting better, but we are nowhere near where we need to be. Things have improved with Me Too over the last 5 years, but I would say we're like 3% down the road, whereas before we were like 1.5% down the road or something. So that's a big jump in terms of, you know, we've doubled our distance down the road, but we've got a long way to go. So it's happening a lot. But you ask, why would a straight man sexually assault another man? And there are a lot of possible reasons that I wrote down here. One is that a perpetrator, male, could be a psychopath who just wants to harm somebody, and they know that they can harm people in a variety of ways, and using sexuality is one of those ways. So they're just motivated by harming another person. A sexual sadist is another conceptualization related to psychopathy. These individuals get off on sexually acting on another person who feels harmed. They actually want the victim to be harmed. That's a part of their pleasure of it. So getting away from psychopathy and sadism and perhaps going into the world of just a much more likely scenario among men, because this happens a lot, right? Like a scenario that I can make up off the top of my head would be like you're in the locker room after working out at the gym and your obnoxious friend walks up to you. And so, you know, two men, your obnoxious friend walks up to you while you're naked and just starts picking you up or
slaps your ass, slaps you with a towel.
Yeah. Or literally flicks you in the dick or something, yeah. You know what I mean? Or makes fun of you or something. So, you know, these kinds of things happen a lot. Or you are drunk and say you're at a party and you know, retreat with your partner, say you're heterosexual, with a woman into a bedroom somewhere, and then five of your male friends bum rush into the room and do a dog pile and everyone's laughing and they leave, and you and your partner are not happy with that, or they film you or something. You know, those are sexual violations and assaults that aren't usually framed that way.
Wedgies are sexual violations.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you go around, you give a wedgie to a kid. And I mean, as a kid, hopefully not adults, but you know, like, that feels like, you know, for the kids, like, we gave them a wedgie. First of all, that's extremely violating and personal and demeaning and stuff. And it is like, you're literally grabbing their underwear and ripping it out from their genitals. And it's like, it's a sexual violation.
Well, it depends, because if you were in a group of guys, which I've been in before, who either explicitly or implicitly consent to that pranksterism.
Yeah.
And everyone knows where the line is or when not to do it, then it raises the risk of a violation happening, particularly if the men feel pressured to play along when they don't really want to. But you could have a scenario where people, regardless of gender, play games like that with each other that they would never play with other people, but they understand that there's a line that they won't cross, that if they enter into this social interaction, they are saying, yes, I know that this might happen to me. Plus, I like to do it to other people. You know, I'm not saying across the board these kinds of behaviors are.
It's just risky, especially. Okay.
So super risky.
The way
and
I saw
often
it,
there's a lot of assaults that happen through what you're talking about, because how many young men or teenagers are explicitly asking for consent?
The way I saw it was in Colombia. It luckily never happened to me, but friends of mine, it did happen to. I saw it, and what it was is like, it would be last day of school or some, you know, it was usually when there was less teacher supervision.
But was this bullying or was this friends?
Oh, no, it was definitely bullying.
Okay, so they would just walk up to
a roving gang of some of the dudes, often from an older grade, you know, would walk around looking for victims.
Ugh.
And like, there it is. And then the guy would run. And if they catch him, it's like they wedgie, beat him up a bit. Like, it's bullying. It's full on bullying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Complete abuse.
Yeah. However, for me, when I was in high school, I had a group of friends and we were very close.
Yeah.
And it was the late mid 80s. So I don't know, of course, how everyone felt about it. And I wasn't one of the main participators in this, but we would regularly look for people who would be vulnerable to wedgies, or what we called atomic wedgies, which are even bigger wedgies. As far as I know, me and all my friends who I'm still friends with will laugh about it today. Yeah. So I will say that within this category, it's a fertile ground for people to enact their issues, one being insecurity. A young man or a teenage boy might, because of insecurities, he might assert his dominance on another man as a way of trying to make up for that insecurity. Another is that it is kind of socially sanctioned in our society, and particularly in certain pockets of our society, like in sports and this sort of thing. And it
hazing rituals, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you could, but even more broadly, it's just, it's, you know, boys will be boys.
Yeah.
And oh, those teenage boys, they're so rambunctious. So it's a way of communicating. And so I'll just speak for myself that when I was younger, in, you know, late teens, early 20s, of course, socialized as a male in my society, I had internalized all the notions of I can't be vulnerable, I can't be kind really, especially if it's overt, I can't ask for my needs to be met, I have to be tough,
yeah.
I can't cry, but I am allowed to be physical, hostile, maybe violent, and sexual within a certain narrow band. but all the other human experiences, of which there are thousands, are completely off limits. And so if I want to, and I remember actually, I believe I noted this before I was educated in, you know, when I was 16, about how much physical touching me and my friends engaged in high school. And we were very, very close as friends, and still are. And we were constantly touching each other in various different ways. And I remember thinking at the time, I think we are hormonal and have a lot of pent-up energy around physical intimacy, maybe with, you know, women, girls, other teenage girls, but also just for humans, you know, because one of the things that happens in mainstream American society to teenagers, and particularly to teenage boys, is there's this expectation that, like with your daughters, for example, there's probably a lot of hugging and kissing and rough play or just hands-on stuff, you know, just like your youngest bumps up against you and daddy, Fast forward to when, you know, like your older daughter starting to get into that zone where it's not her impulse, right?
No.
Because she wants to act more adult or she doesn't want to interact with daddy. She wants to interact with her friends. So there's those impulses. And when that happens, often there's a change in the family and a loss for the parents and a loss for the kids.
Right.
Where, okay, you know, like you might have even encountered this where you tried to engage physically with your older daughter in a way that you would have normally. And she's like, dad, you know, and not,
totally.
not like, oh, dad, like, what are you doing? And like overnight, right? You could just have this feeling like, wait, but I just did this. What are you talking about? We've been, right?
Right. There was an age. Now I don't even remember when it stopped. There was an age when I would just be like, oh, come here and just like hug her. Now, to be fair, my oldest was never cuddler with me. I think she was a cuddler, more of a cuddler with her mom, but not with me. Whereas the younger one is a total daddy cuddler. But even then, there was an age where I would just like, hi, come here. And then
I have this really cute video of you and her, your oldest, and she would have been 4 or 5-ish. And she is pressing up again. You're sitting down and she's like kind of cuddling with you. And she goes, I love you, daddy.
Oh. And I'm pushing her away. So I don't. You need to be better as a person. No, but so yeah, I would used to. And then at some point, probably started around 9, but certainly by now, the hugs weren't automatically accepted. It would be like, hey, like now, for example, I'm like, oh, hey. I always like wait a little bit because she'll be like, eh. And then she'll kind of go along with it. But it's not like, oh, come here, dad, right? It's like, hey, you know? Like, oh, yeah. Whereas the little one's always climbing all over me.
Right.
And when she's watching TV, the little one will automatically cuddle up. And I'm like, oh. And she cuddles with her mom, too. But I feel like she cuddles with me a lot more, except if it's bedtime, you know? And then, I don't know. At some point, I'm sure the same thing will happen where she'll get to be like that age and it'll start getting less. Maybe not as much, but still.
Right. Yeah. So everyone has a loss there. There's a gain.
Totally.
That the child has anyway of, which is often what parenting is all about, is you just lose and the child gains. So the child gains this maturity, this sense of being an adult, this sense of independence, a sense of I'm my own person. I don't need that. That's child stuff. And the parent just loses, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you get the gratification of seeing a child grow and become independent.
I still enjoy these moments. Like the other day, it was Halloween. And she had watched in school, they had watched like some sort of scary short movie. It's called Don't Answer the Surveyor. I don't remember. No. He dies at the end. That's what it's called. He dies at the end. I guess he dies at the end. She was freaked out by it. And so she at the end of the evening, we had already trick or treated all these things, and we had watched an episode of something, and then we're ready to go upstairs, and she's like, wait, daddy, like, walk with me. We're like, she needed me. I was needed. She was freaked out.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes. I've still got it.
Yeah. The point is that for children, they have this experience regardless of gender, but for boys, it can be particularly bad because they've been absorbing all this culture and they really want to know. Boys might even start this rejection of hugging even earlier than that, right? And so you have all of this unmet need among boys, and then boys tend to congregate together, not always, of course, but it's a common pattern. It was for me. And you are constantly around these other guys, I was, and you don't have an outlet for your emotions, but you start to emote a little bit with each other, and then all of this affection just starts happening, and then there's horseplay, which is something that is ingrained in us, apparently, and you see other primates and other mammals do this as well, other social animals that raise...
My dog and my cat, on a daily basis, horseplay for like an hour or more.
Yeah. One of the factors that I remember reading in helping children develop is having horseplay with their parents. It's not usually something we think about, right?
Yeah.
We think about love and attunement, but horseplay is associated with improvements in development and outcomes for children, like learning and emotional stability and stuff, which seems kind of weird, you know? Of course, there's bad horseplay, but a lot of horseplay teaches a lot of things. It teaches children that they can be powerful. Often that is the play, is that the child has power over the bigger person.
And boundaries.
Yeah.
As an example, with the talking about the dogs, right? Like when the dog is a puppy, they will learn not to be too rough because the other dog, especially if the other dog is older and knows better, will actually bite back a bit.
Right.
Not to hurt them, but to be like, no, you've gone too far.
Right. And humans are the same. And also you learn how to communicate, how to assert your needs. You learn how to read other people's minds, you know, because the facial expression, I've gone too far, or they're enjoying this, you know, you're bonding. It's a physical experience. Like cuddling, it can be very bonding, which I think I'd never thought about this because you'll see these scenes sometimes in reality where people will get into a physical fight and then they start crying. They start crying and then they hug, even though they don't even know each other. You know what I mean? And for some men who are struggling with a lot of trauma, it's like that movie with Casey Affleck, Manchester by the Sea, right?
Don't spoil it because I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Okay.
But well, I know, you know, it's tragic and stuff. Do they get in a fight? Is there a fight?
Yeah, there's just, it's not spoiling it. He has a trauma that you learn about in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
His brother dies or something?
Well, don't say it. I won't spoil
it. Don't
spoil it. His brother, don't say it! And then he, at some point, I can't remember if he says or it's implied that he has all this pent up emotion and pain, but he has no way of processing it.
Oh.
But he does go to a bar. They're these like fisher community folks. And he goes to this rough and tumble bar and he purposely gets super drunk and then gets into a fight. And it is seemingly an outlet for him.
Yeah. Right?
You can get rid of some anger, but you can also have a physical intimacy in a way, or just an interaction with somebody. You know, sometimes you just need that person that you can sort of bump up against in a hard way, you know.
Sometimes you just need to point a finger at someone's face.
So it becomes, for a lot of teenagers, a socially sanctioned way of communicating things that are denied in other ways.
Yeah.
I imagine that if teenagers were allowed to express the full range of their needs, roughhousing would be a part of that, but it wouldn't be as needed. So then you have that culture and that expectation among a group of men or boys, and you add in a lot of trauma or difficulty or insecurity or other kinds of issues, then that is going to be communicated through that behavior and will cause victimization and harm. Or because of the cultural expectation of boys will be boys, it just creates a scenario where victimization is just very likely to happen because the boys can't say no to it because that's being like a girl or being a wuss or something. And so I think that's what I came up with in terms of answering your question, Anonymous Patron, as to why, because you're asking, you know, why would self-identified straight men target other men in that way. That, you know, if we're talking about severe targeting, then we're more likely looking at sexual sadism or psychopathy or some kind of learned behavior of their own that they've been through of some sort. All right, let's take a break. We get back more emails. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP, Berto. What do you say?
OPP.
So these people became patrons all the way back in 2021, and they do not have any address listed. So
oh, no. We'll have to make it up.
They're all from God knows where.
Planets.
We have Tom and Matthew and Anna and Sanga and Andrea and King Kongo and Katie and Roshni. And Christine, and Katie, and Kira, and Victoria, and Alina, and Julia, and Margaret, and Desiree, and Megan, and MK, Aletta, Silja, Daniel, Pauline, Jenny, Jessica, Kimberly, Lisa, Joshua, and Nicola. Thank you for becoming a patron all the way back in 2021. And staying a patron through thick and thin. Right, Berto?
It's amazing. Yes.
Okay.
This reminds me, I have a new cameo that I gotta finish. Or oh. Do. I got a cameo request yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Hit Berto up for a cameo. He really enjoys doing that kind of thing. It's a fun thing for me as well. All right. Let's go on to an email. Okay. So email from anonymous listener. She says, when I was 18 and still in school, my 38-year-old married art teacher and I began an intimate relationship. This relationship lasted for 2 years. I told my mom when my teacher, he was trying to end things with me, and we ended up going to school about it, me and my mom. His teaching license was revoked, and our entire school district found out that it was him and me. I am 25 now, 5 years later, and he is still married, and I have struggled to comprehend what exactly happened back then. I was 18, so I was of age, but with the power dynamic and intense feelings, it has really messed me up. Since then, two other girls have come forward, but that doesn't negate the fact that I thought I was in love. Meaning that she is thinking, well, wait, I thought I was unique, but maybe he was doing this to a lot of people, so was it love, actually? And I am embarrassingly still trying to cope with everything that happened. I've been trying to find podcasts or interviews on male teacher-student relationships, but have not come across any, and I feel that your perspective on this could help a lot of people who have gone through the same thing or something similar. Berto, what do you think?
Oh, man. How painful. You know, I used to have this weird perspective. When I was younger, I had this perspective about female teachers and male students that was really immature, not only immature as in I was being immature, but I was an immature way to think about it. I thought like those were okay. You know, I'm talking about like, you know, when I was in my 20s or something and some of these Mary Kay Letourneau or other things came out and I was like, what's the problem?
So even though Mary Kay Letourneau, a local teacher near Seattle, was having at the very least a very heavily romantic affair, eventually sexual affair.
Yeah.
And the relationship started when the kid was
13 or something?
What? No, he was in fifth grade.
Fifth grade is how old?
That's like 10 and 11-ish.
All right, so maybe that one would have, maybe that one was, I never felt it was, but there was somewhere it was like the Florida teacher and they were like, you know, in ninth grade or 10th grade or something like that. And the Florida teacher was really attractive at the time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the prevailing.
Yeah, I'm not saying I was alone in this, but at the time, even though I had been abused as a child and even though all these things, and we've been doing all this, even though I still would be like, I don't know. You know, I remember being a teenage boy and blah, blah. And it took me a while to be like, no, actually, no.
Yeah, let me just talk a little bit about that as an asterisk, which is that it really shows you how fucked up our society is that intelligent, well, not only are you smart, but you are in literally like the 99 percentile. I've tested you. That for someone of your intelligence and your wisdom regarding how the world works, you didn't just crawl out of a cave.
Right.
You're in touch with things. You've been in therapy back then, even when you had this point of view. It really says something about how fucked up our culture is, that it's incomprehensible that a woman could coerce or harm or sexually assault or abuse an underage boy in this way. I mean, just think about how many messages have been injected into your head, subtle and not so subtle messages, for you to be cut off from the obvious conclusion that it's a that it's an abusive relationship. You know what I mean?
Yes. And because there's two aspects to it. One of them is absolutely what you're saying. But there's this other aspect, which is, look, I still maintain that if we rewound the clock, and maybe this is not a controversial maintenance, but if I were 16 and a really attractive teacher came on to me and stuff like that, maybe even like kissed me or something, whatever, I would have probably been flattered and would have thought, oh, this is cool. You know, the thing that no one teaches you, certainly not society, but no one mentions this, is that even if something feels right on the surface to you at the time, it might still be traumatizing you.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, that's what happened to you when you were five.
Exactly. But and I think that that's sometimes lost, because certainly there's all the kind of male chauvinist conversations and like, oh, males are in power, males should be, there's all that and like womanizing and all these things. Absolutely. And none of that helps. And we also don't talk about that, not just in that case. So in so many cases in life, just because you in the moment feel okay and think it's fine. Like, take another example. It's like you're at work. And your boss, not even sexually, your boss aggressively insults you and targets you and asks you to stay late and do something. But in the moment, you just, you know, you feel like, wow, that's just, yeah, we got to go the extra mile. That's just the way it is here in this company or whatever. And you think you're fine. It doesn't mean it's fine. It doesn't mean you're okay. It doesn't mean you weren't traumatized. Similarly, even if a 17-year-old boy is hormonal and does find the teacher attractive and blah, 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 it doesn't mean it's okay. It doesn't mean they're not traumatized. Mm-hmm. So with that out of the way, now when we talk about the other direction, I actually believe that in this case, the person who's narrating their story probably in the moment felt that it was fine and felt like they were in love and they felt all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And sadly, it didn't mean it was okay, and it didn't feel it was fair. It was abusive, and it wasn't their fault, and it was all these things, right? So now, I can totally understand how, even after knowing all that, they, A, still have feelings for the person, B, still feel confused about the thing, and even after learning that there were other victims, they're still like, oh, but it still feels like love. Mm-hmm. It's like, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The public discourse around this lacks even a little bit of nuance in it for a topic that has a lot of nuance. And what you'll hear from people is they'll say, well, he was a monstrous predator and you're a victim and you were harmed and you weren't really in love. And that's the end of the story.
And I'm sure you weren't into it.
Yeah. You were just a child. You were a hapless idiot or something. Yeah. And it's really harmful to the victims when that lack of nuance is constantly parroted. I mean, you talk about this online or even, and of course, online reflects how people talk in real life often, and this is true in this case, that you know, people will just say, oh, he's a monster, and I'm so sorry that you were preyed upon in that way. What a psychopath, and maybe he is, but it's complicated. You didn't say this, anonymous listener, but it sounds like it's possible that you still have feelings. You don't probably want to actually be with him, but you do have a part of your heart that misses him and is still reeling from the breakup, maybe even just from the breakup, let alone from everything that happened afterwards and the realization of being victimized. So it's, you know, it's pretty awful. And obviously there's a lot of discourse around that this is your fault and you should have known better. How come you didn't say no? You must be stupid, or, you know, that kind of stuff, which is really awful.
As an example, I can't be sure of this, but I would bet heavily on it. I was, my abuser was 12 when I was five. It was a female babysitter. If I had ran into that person when I was, say, 21, 22, fully adult, and I had, you know, some social event, a party or something, and I run into them, if they had wanted to re-abuse me, and I mean re-abuse me as in, you know, have sex, even if I didn't really want to, I bet you it would have worked. Because I would have probably felt feelings and been like, ooh.
Right. Okay. So there were real understandable feelings
that
you felt for her during and for a long time after. Right. Maybe even to the, I mean, do you?
No, nowadays it's, I only feel sadness and
revulsion.
No, actually, I did. I went through that phase because I won't go into detail, but I realized I was re-traumatizing myself in certain ways. And then I went through a phase of revulsion. Mm-hmm. But now I've kind of come to this whole other part where I'm like...
Yeah, but when you were 20...
Oh, yeah, certainly.
You still had a warm place in your heart because while you were going through, because I've heard you talk about this, that you felt like she was treating you in this very special way, that you were in this inner circle. She was abusing another 5-year-old boy, and the two of you knew that.
And we felt special.
And you both felt special. And when you have that kind of relationship, you know, it's not like she jumped out of a bush and held a knife to your neck. There's a lot of intimacy. She was your babysitter. Yeah. There's a lot of things that are happening outside of the abuse where you're just playing games and you're laughing together and watching TV.
Well, and if she hadn't abused me, I would have thought the world anyways of her.
Right.
Right. Like, oh, she's so cool.
Right. And maybe those things were legitimate. Of course, when you hear people talk about that, they will say, well, they don't usually do it in this case, but like with the anonymous listener, in all likelihood, the interactions you had with your teacher / boyfriend, I guess you could say, boyfriend is a funny, you know, but that's how she might have felt it in the time. It wasn't like, you know, 100% of the time he was quote unquote preying on you. There was probably a lot of moments where you were being intimate and sharing things and crying together, listening to each other's feelings. And those, so when you talk about that with other people, and you might even have this in your own mind, is that, well, obviously he was only doing this so he could get into my pants. He was gaslighting me, or he was tricking me. And so all that good behavior or that bonding behavior or kind behavior from him was in service of abusing me. And that could be true, but it isn't always the case. And it's debatable because we can't really measure it scientifically. But my conceptualization, hearing from a lot of victims who have gone through situations like this, is that those were legitimate, bonding, altruistic, nice moments between two people, even though one person was the overall abuser and one person was the overall victim. One could legitimately call that love, could legitimately call that bonding. It's in the midst of a lot of harm that's happening, and it's very harmful and very problematic to the victim, but it's genuine and it's real. And what do you do with that afterwards? Who do you talk with about that? How do you mourn that? How do you grieve it? You didn't give us what exactly happened, anonymous listener, but I wouldn't be surprised if the sequence was, this was perhaps one of the most intense relationships you'd ever been in your life. And it's possible that you came into the scenario as an 18-year-old with past traumas relationally yourself. We all have some relational traumas, but it's possible that you had some susceptibility to this. I don't want to say that automatically, of course, because anyone can be susceptible to this, but it's possible that you had some abandonment issues or something like this. And so this relationship could have been intensified because of that. But regardless of that, it's quite possible that that relationship, that two-year relationship, was very, very intense for a lot of reasons. One is that you could kind of think of it as a two-person cult where you have one person is the leader and the other person is the follower of a cult, because it's very insular by its nature. And sometimes individuals like him will inadvertently or on purpose engage in relationships like this because of the insular nature of it. It would be implied and probably explicitly discussed that you could not reveal the relationship, right? So there's all sorts of things that can't be talked about. And you automatically create an in-group and an out-group. And by creating an in-group, you create a lot of necessity for sharing and for bonding that really just propels people together. And it separates you from everyone else in your life. It separates you from your family because you can't tell them. Separates you from your friends. You can't tell them. Separates you maybe even from yourself, because there's a part of you that's saying, this is not okay. You have to reject even your own instincts. And so it is this really all-encompassing experience for victims where it is very intense and can have legitimate love feelings that maybe we can all relate to in those scenarios. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. And then you go through the breakup, he breaks up with you, and you're devastated and you're hurt and you're confused, and you tell your mom, and your mom says, oh my God, we have to report this. And right away, a report happens, and then a whirlwind of police activity and hearings and rumors and, you know, people talking about things, people reaching out to you. I mean, you're 25 now, so this was during the age of the internet and social media. I can't imagine what that would be like. I mean, when I was in high school, things like this would happen, but they were rumor upon rumor upon rumor. I mean, because, you know, there were teachers in my school that were rumored to have had relationships with students. I'm pretty sure that there was one that was confirmed because I was closer to this teacher for various reasons. But a lot of times today, people just can show text receipts and be like, here you go. Anyway, point is that you go straight from the most intense cult-like, but, you know, legitimate love, at least on your end, relationship, to, oh my God, I'm so devastated for this loss, to, oh my God, all these hearings, all these reports, the whole world, I'm shamed, what's happening here? Maybe even your family is like looking at you like, what happened? And then your grieving process is just completely halted because no one has the ability to listen to you, and everyone's point of view is weird. And you start to question, you know, you start being gaslit by the reaction from everyone because you're just like, and again, I don't know if this happened to you, anonymous listener, but I could imagine, where you're just like, but I feel a longing for him. So I must be crazy, right? There must be something wrong with me. I'm weak. I'm crazy. I'm just as bad as he is. I'm ashamed. You know, because like there's some of the things that you said in the email, you're like, I was 18, so I was of age. Being eight, it's not like when you turn 18 on your 18th birthday, suddenly like all bets are off and 17 and 364 days, you're this hapless, vulnerable victim and suddenly turning 18 and you have this resilience that can withstand these sorts of things. No.
That's why in my example, I said 22. I could have been 22, 25. Like I could have been older than, way older than being an adult.
You could be any age. You could be 75 and be exploited by someone that has more power than you. You know?
And I'm feeling like in that moment, that victim is going through this weird split thing. On the one hand, it's likely your friends, family, those close to you are probably only having a reaction of disgust and aversion for the monstrosity that happened, which is totally understandable. But it's unlikely that you're getting conversations like, man, you must really miss him, huh? Like, you must feel, because you were in love. Huh? Like, you're probably not having those conversations.
I mean, people don't have these conversations anyway.
To begin with.
Yeah, like, if you have a breakup, particularly if there's some identified toxic element.
You gotta move on. Come on.
Yeah.
You get better fish in the sea. Like, he was an asshole anyways.
Right.
Let alone in this case, right? So that's happening or not happening. And on the other side of the coin, a lot of abusers like to use examples of, oh, well, you know, the victim was really into it. Like, you should see this love letter they wrote me. And I'm here to tell you, when I was 5, I couldn't wait to see my babysitter. And I told a story before about this one trip we took as families together. And I was begging to take a shower with her, naked shower with her and stuff like that. So what is that evidence of? Oh, it's fine. Look, the little 5-year-old Berto is fine with not only, he's asking for it. Mm-hmm. No.
Right.
Nowhere near.
Yeah.
And so like all the feelings she had, all this stuff, you could imagine the family not acknowledging that, friends and stuff. And then the other side of the fence, using, you see, it's not just me, it's a two-way street here.
Right, it wouldn't be uncommon for someone in her shoes to, even after all is said and done, after the hearings and all this stuff comes out, even learning about these two other victims, it wouldn't be uncommon for her to, late one night, maybe after a couple glasses of wine, texting him and being like, I miss you.
Yeah,
that is totally normal. Now, the other aspect of this, of course, is the tremendous harm that likely happened to you. I don't know, and I don't like it when people assume this, but in all likelihood, who knows? Because there's a pretty good chance that from 18 to 20, maybe particularly in the beginning, but really maybe throughout, there was a voice in your head that was saying, something's wrong here, something's wrong here, something's wrong here. And you might have even voiced it to him, like, something's wrong here, right? But he had some way of circumventing that or convincing you. It depends on the approach or the relationship. And then it gets in your head, and then that voice that is saying something's wrong here, you know, at the very least, there's something wrong because I can't tell anyone. I can't tell my parents. I can't tell my friends. I have to hide all of this. There's something wrong here. Then you have to suppress that voice, and you start, you know, like it's the cult example is, or the cult analogy is apt here, because after being extracted, your brain hasn't extracted. Your relationship ended when he broke up with you and everything happened, but the indoctrination and the screwed up mind is still with you. And without a lot of therapy to sift through all that, you don't know where those things are because they don't necessarily show themselves in an overt way. And they can even perpetuate the problem because if you don't trust yourself or you shame yourself or blame yourself, then you don't know to actually voice that and get help for it. You just think, well, I'm just a disgusting person. I should have known better, that sort of thing. So the answer to all this is long-term therapy. There's a good chance there's a lot of other sort of harm and syndromes that you might be suffering from. You don't mention that. There's also a chance that you don't have that. It's a chance that it's more on the level of the grief and the confusion and not some ongoing traumatic experience for you. But you know, I'm really sorry it happened to you. And I'm also sorry that society and maybe the people around you are terrible supporters. They're trying to support, they want to help, but our society gives not only no guidance or protocol around this, but they give they do give a protocol and guidance. It's the wrong guidance, though, is the thing. All right, let's take a break. We get back more emails. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
Okay, we're back from the break. So I have a gift for you, Berto.
What?
You've already seen this, but okay. The fan art individual, the fan, Soft Noodles, you might have seen the comic that she made of you.
Yeah.
But she sent the hard copy.
This is the actual thing.
So you can have the hard copy.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm going to frame this.
The main kind of joke, which she made one of these for all of us, is that there's a very frequent flashback to your jacket story.
Yeah.
And in the last episode that we recorded, it happened again.
I literally mentioned the jacket. Yes, it's true. It's so good.
So the bingo card would have...
It definitely would have jacket on it.
Yeah. So email from patron Jennifer. She writes and she says, for the next Berto episode, are there any movies in 2023 that you two are looking forward to going to see?
Oh, so, yeah.
I think this email was sent to us in early 2023.
Okay.
So are there any future movies that you know about that you're like, what?
We have to watch the new Scorsese, the
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah.
I also want to watch the new,
Napoleon.
What?
Napoleon. The movie Napoleon.
Oh, right. I didn't even think about that one. Was that the Fincher one? No.
Oh, no. There's Fincher. The Fincher one. Yeah, I texted it to you.
Right, so there's Fincher, there's Napoleon, there's the
killer.
Moon.
The killer, yeah.
I never ended up seeing Oppenheimer, so I guess I still need to see Oppenheimer. And then, of course, Dune's coming out.
Dune 2, yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, those movies, Inside Out 2 is coming out, which I'm worried about. But,
wait, what?
But could be amazing, yeah.
Inside Out 2?
So I'm guessing the girl is now a teenager.
That could be great.
It could be great.
Could be
bad.
Could be Cars 2.
Yeah. Well, Cars 1 wasn't good. So.
Cars 1 was good. It wasn't Inside Out level.
Yeah.
But Cars 1 was a fine movie. Yeah.
But if you think about the...
Yeah, its stack ranks low, but...
Another movie is Poor Things, which is the latest movie from the director of The Favorite, Yorgos Lanthimos.
Interesting. I like The Favorite.
Yeah, I loved The Favorite.
Dune, that was really good.
Dune 2, I absolutely will watch and will probably enjoy it, but I know the story so well
that
when I watch Dune 1.
Which is how you and I felt about Dune 1.
Yeah.
We were like, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But we do know it.
Yeah. It'd be like watching a remake beat for beat of Star Wars, a New Hope. You know what I mean?
Right. That would be so weird.
Because I actually like the Lynch version. I think that the...
I love the Lynch version.
Denis Villeneuve version is empirically better on a lot of levels.
The second half of the Lynch version, and I think it's because they didn't let him cut it the way he wanted,
right,
loses a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But
It's still great.
But in a lot of ways, if you watch those two movies side by side, the beats are the same. You know, the look is different, of course.
I will also say, and people are like my friend Seth and my brother would hate to hear this. If you were going to say which one was way more inventive and out there?
Oh, David Lynch.
Lynch.
Yeah. Right.
When I saw that movie as a child, I probably understood 5% of it.
Yeah, me too.
And yet my brain was never again the same.
I mean, Villeneuve is a master at cinematography.
Oh, yeah, and it was amazing.
And mood. So,
but nothing about it did I go,
oh, right,
I've never seen that before.
Another movie, Deadpool 3.
That's coming out?
Yeah, soon. Whoa. So Deadpool 1 and 2.
They're so fun, dude.
Are two of my favorite movies of all time.
Very fun.
I mean, I've rewatched Deadpool 2 in particular, and there's a version of it where they had interstitials of Deadpool, like in Princess Bride.
Breaking the seventh wall.
well, you know, in Princess Bride, where the grandpa comes and reads to Fred Savage,
yeah.
Deadpool comes
and reads the, isn't it?
I think it's an adult Fred Savage
yeah.
who is duct taped,
yeah. And he's forced to listen.
Yeah. And
I saw that version.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's like a Christmas version or something. And by the way, I also rewatched Princess Bride last week. And I was watching on my computer. I was watching, did you know that famous people remade Princess Bride during the pandemic? And they shot it at home on their phones?
This sounds familiar.
So it was this fundraising thing for, I think, what's called World Kitchen or something. And some
shot scenes.
Some organizer just
did
started.
Did they do the whole movie?
They did the whole movie.
The whole movie.
But another movie is Furiosa. We the other night with Seth, we were talking about
Morty Face.
Oh, you didn't. I thought we saw it together.
I like that movie. Did I need a sequel?
Well, it's made by the guy. Yeah. What's his face?
George. Whatever his name is.
Yeah.
George Romero or George?
No. Miller.
Miller.
And Joker 2 with Joaquin Phoenix. Are you worried about it? Because you liked the first one, right?
I love the Joker.
Yeah.
Did you watch American Psycho 2?
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's going to be that, because American Psycho 2 was literally a low-budget horror movie with Mila Kunis. I've just been burned so many times by superhero movies
But Joaquin Phoenix, he is...
Right, yeah.
Even in this movie, or Joker 1, my understanding was that Joaquin and Todd Phillips worked very closely together to make sure that it wasn't cheesy. And that's hard to do with a movie like this.
Yeah,
you know
I know.
I mean?
But it's the problem with horror movies that are great in the first 75%, and then they got to fish or cut bait. Are we going to show the witch? Are we going to show the ghost?
Who hurt you?
Horror movies hurt me. No, what's going to happen, dude?
The Phantom Menace hurt
is
you.
In the first movie, they had plausible deniability about whether it was actually a Joker movie and whether it was about superheroes or not, whether it was supernatural or not, or any of that stuff. In the second movie, now they're going to have to fish or cut bait. I'm worried.
I'm worried too. I'm worried about Inside Out 2. I'm not worried about Deadpool 3.
No, I'm not worried about Deadpool 3. I'm actually not that worried about Inside Out 2 because, like you said, it's their A-team. Come on now.
Yeah. Napoleon, I'm a little worried about because I like history and I know a little bit about Napoleon.
How accurate it's going to be?
No, because it's not going to be. In fact, there's a scene that I'm already like, that is stretching it. Like in the previews, they show this scene where he's shooting cannon at this ice lake and da da da. I won't bore you with the details, but it very likely did not play out like that. But there was an event during a battle that had that element. But it's and also like the way that Joaquin Phoenix seems to be directed, and maybe his own choices of playing Napoleon, is that Napoleon is this stoic, upset person, but that's the way today we look at leaders that are badass. But Napoleon wasn't badass for a lot of his life. You know what I mean? He had to schmooze. He was very charismatic. He smiled and laughed. I've heard great things about Killers of the Flower
Moon. Yeah, I can't wait to watch that. Only that it's 3 and 40 minutes.
Yeah. But I'm glad because the story is very involved.
Oh, is this based on a real thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wow. Yeah. I mean, maybe you shouldn't know. I mean, I know this story.
I don't want to know anything.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
But it's a real story. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And from what I can tell, the movie steers away from being too speculative.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's speculative okay. about
because this is like Native Americans and all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the real people.
Real people.
And there's some speculation as to Leo DiCaprio's demeanor, but the events that happened, you know, factual things. And
I watched part of the preview and I was like, I stopped watching because I'm like, okay, I'm in. I just want to see this.
Yeah. And my point is that it's good that it's long because there's so many things that happen in the story and it spans a number of years. And
yeah, we just got to go watch it early then.
Yeah. So that's that. All right. Next question. Middle tier patron Alexandra, she asks, dear Kirk and Berto, Kirk, you mentioned that you used to do competitive wrestling as a kid. If you and Berto were to wrestle, who would win?
Wrestling Honda would kick my butt because I did some Brazilian jiu-jitsu for like a half second as an adult. But unfortunately, it was already later in life, so I didn't learn that much. And as a kid, I specifically remember being bad at wrestling because my brother and I we used to roughhouse, you know. And because I was older when he was younger, it was like not a competition, right? I just put him down. Right. Then we started getting a little older, and he also started getting buff and stuff like that. And I started not, because, you know, in high school, I was athletic. I did swimming, and I did weightlifting, and I did cross country. I was athletic. So I was strong. I could endure all these things. Then I went to college, and I just like, I mean, I would do stuff, but not much. Running a little bit. He was still in high school and doing more, and actually did learn some wrestling moves from friends of his. He didn't do competitive wrestling, but he learned wrestling. And so then, even just with that little bit, I would come home from college and we would roughhouse and he started being able to pin me. And I was so confused because I'd be like, I was stronger than him. So I could push up and get him. I could still overpower him, but it would take so much effort. And then after a while, he got a little older, then I freaking couldn't get him off me. And I'm like, okay, I don't understand what's happening. Like I literally physically didn't understand what was happening. Flash forward to when I took Brazilian jiu-jitsu and I started understanding, oh, there's these weird levels to this stuff.
Yeah.
And like these weird thing where if you apply your weight this way and you let, oh, didn't get it. So absolutely. Now, if Hana and I boxed or kickboxed, maybe I could do something.
Because
I did taekwondo.
Yeah, no, I'm not trained
in
any sort of...
But wrestling is still...
But yeah, wrestling, you know, I think a lot of people might look at it and think that it's this brutish sport of muscles, and
but no.
It couldn't be further from the truth. It is technique and leverage.
I think because of World War, you know, the Wrestling Federation, the you know, WWF.
Yeah.
And I grew up thinking the same thing, that wrestling was like, you got to be these huge dudes and you're just slamming each other into the ground.
Yeah.
And then learned, you know, it's all fake anyways.
And I'm bigger than you.
Right.
So there's that. But
weight class really matters in wrestling and boxing.
But, oh, yeah. Big time. And I was always one of the highest weight classes. I believe I was in the weight class just below heavyweight. So if I weighed, you know, 5 pounds heavier, I'd be in the unlimited class where you could be. So I really didn't want to be in that class because you could go up against just monsters.
Right.
But at the same time, I was also very good at wrestling. I played all the sports that kids play, you know, soccer and football and baseball and basketball. I even played volleyball. But with wrestling, paradoxically, it was probably my best sport that I excelled at, but I hated it the most because it was so stressful.
So hard.
I hated being under the spotlight one-on-one.
Yeah.
You know,
and the weight cutting was difficult.
Weight cutting, that didn't bother me so much, but looking back, it's pretty awful. But yeah, I mean, I would put saran wrap around my body and put sweats on, and I'd just run around in my house, and I wouldn't eat anything.
Right.
Just to make, and then you weigh in, and then you quickly eat a bunch of calories so you can manage to wrestle. And everyone does it, but if none of us did it, then we'd all be healthy kids, and we'd just bump up our weights by a few pounds or something. Anyway, But
if everyone had a gentleman's agreement to just do it at your normal way.
Yeah.
But of course that.
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah. I would stress so much about wrestling.
Yeah.
I think I've talked about this before, that there was, during the wrestling season, there was only one evening that I was not stressed, and it was after the match. So I'd have the match at, like, you know, 5 o'clock or something. I'd go home and I'd be relaxed. I'd wake up the next day and I'd be instantly stressing about the next match. Yeah. With other sports, like with football, I'm also under the lights, but I have 10 teammates and I'm playing against 11 other people. And it's just.
And in football, in any given game, there's ups and downs anyways.
Right.
Like, even the best players are never, like, 100% hitting ever, you know.
Right. I don't think I thought about that. Yeah. Like, with wrestling, the match might be, like, 10 minutes-ish, depending if everyone lasts that long without getting pinned. And so you have this 10-minute period of pure terror.
Yeah.
Whereas with football, like you said, you could have a bad 10-minute span in a football game and make up for it.
Yeah.
Plus, I had teammates. So when I went to college, I was in a fraternity, and a lot of the older guys would hear that I was a wrestler, and they would challenge me because I was younger, and I don't know if it was a conscious thing, but when I was growing up, I was seen by a lot of people as a jock. I was captain of the wrestling team. I was captain of the football team. I walked around school in my jersey and my Letterman's jacket with the other jocks at times, you know?
Right. And you were bigger at the time. In like lower grades,
relative to the other kids. Yeah, I was 6 foot, like, way before other. I had friends that were like under 5 feet.
But then if you get to college, there might be some big, you know, defensive linebackers in college.
Right. But my point is that when I went to college, I either consciously or unconsciously just wanted to reject that entire persona and that entire life. And I didn't give off the vibe as a jock.
Right.
I gave off a different vibe. I don't know what vibe that would have been. But
which, for example, when I met you, which was after college, but if I had given a list of things to say that Kirk was, I actually probably wouldn't have included any athletics in there.
No. I probably didn't talk about it. Yeah. I certainly didn't play sports at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so these older guys would think they could take me, and I'd be like, I wouldn't try because I'll beat you. I would ask them, did you wrestle? And they'd be like, no. And I'd be like, well, then it's not a contest. And it was never a contest.
No, but people don't understand that if they haven't actually experienced either direction. And I would have said the same thing. If you and I had that conversation, let's say we were in the same high school and you were wrestling and I at the time was still fresh from Taekwondo. If you're like, let's like tussle or whatever, and it ends in the ground, like in my mind, I would have been shocked that you beat me because I wouldn't have understood at that time anything about wrestling.
Yeah. So, dear listener, the podcast, yes, has turned into middle-aged men talking about...
Who could beat whom up? My dad could be.
Well, talking about their glory days.
Yeah.
And how...
Oh, right. The Al Bundy. Oh, I almost scored that touchdown.
Yes,
man.
Exactly. We are now Al Bundy, who was... The actor was probably younger than us when he was...
Oh, he was, for sure, dude.
All right, last email, Birdo. But let's take a break.
But that was fun. We've never bonded over sports.
just one last story about jiu-jitsu. In college, one of those older guys who was bigger than me, still is, challenged me at a party, actually. So we're at like this house party and he's just like, I'm gonna get you, you know? And I'd never wrestled him before. And I'd beaten all the other upperclassmen, you know? And I was like, okay. And he had taken some sort of martial arts.
So he wasn't a rookie.
Like he's taking jiu-jitsu or something. And so he says, let's wrestle. And then, long story short, he gets me into some kind of submission hold.
Where you have to tap. Or you're supposed to tap if you're hurting or something.
Yeah. I didn't know because this is before I'd ever seen such a thing.
Oh, right. Of course.
This is like 1990.
That's not what you do in... You're wrestling, right?
No, in fact, what he was doing was illegal.
Of course.
Because those kinds of moves can break someone's neck, you know? There's all these rules in wrestling that you can't do things like
and
that.
And in jiu-jitsu, the rule is...
Submit.
You have to tap, and as soon as you feel the tap, you have to let go.
Yeah, I didn't know. But even... You can be very hurt even before you have the chance to tap.
Of course.
And so So I'm basically winning because, so that was the weird thing, was that I beat him in the wrestling match, but he beat me in the jiu-jitsu match.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But he didn't tell me that it was going to be a jiu-jitsu match,
right,
which I found to be sneaky and shady as fuck. And my neck was kind of fucked up after that.
No.
And because when we were going down, because we're just in this small Seattle living room, it was just like a rental of one of our friends and there was a house party.
Not cool.
My foot went cartwheel and hit a window and it hit the blinds and just destroyed these like Venetian blind things, you know? And I...
Nice.
And my friend who lived in the house just kind of went, Because back then, none of us thought we were going to get our damage deposit back.
Do you know, in our late 20s, my brother and I got in a, well, I was even later 20s than him. We got in a wrestling match. Still not, we weren't angry at each other. We were just drunk. A wrestling match on the streets of Seattle in the concrete, on the concrete.
So let's take a break.
Yeah.
When we get back, one last email. That's just kind of funny. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so back from the break. This email is from middle-tier patron Caitlin from Davenport, Iowa. She says, "Hi, Dr. Kirk and Berto. In a recent episode, you mentioned that you enjoyed hearing people share their dreams they had about you. And last night, I had a dream about the two of you."
Oh, my goodness.
"I was at a terrible Broadway show in New York City with my partner. I looked in the row behind me, and there the two of you were, wrestling and trying to kill each other." No, just joking.
Were we pulling a Bobert on each other?
during a weird intermission, have you seen that video, the security camera?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about weird intermissions.
Yeah. "During a weird intermission, I turned around and introduced myself. Dr. Kirk was like, 'Oh, hi, nice to meet you.' And Berto was like, 'Oh, hi, what's up?'"
Oh, hi, what's up?
"I talked about how the show was..."
I was really like nonchalant like that.
Yeah. I talked with the two of you about how the show was really bad and you guys were like, yeah, it's bad. For some reason, I was expecting that Kirk was going to start talking and not stop."
Because we talked for 3 hours nonstop. Yeah, that makes sense.
But you were both expecting me to carry the conversation, which is not something I enjoy a whole lot.
So we were kind of like,
well, we'll get to the end. But I really doubled down and started asking a lot of questions. At one point, I was like, 'Where's Stacy?' And you said she didn't come to the show. The dream was surprisingly realistic in that I can see how you wouldn't really want fans to come up to you during an outing and talk your ear off. I don't know if that's true or not, but I feel like I've listened to you guys so much and you've had such a profound positive effect in my life and I feel like I know you. Anyway, see you on the podcast. Caitlin, Berto, what do you think?"
I mean, that's awesome. I'm glad we didn't do anything bad. Like, that's great. We didn't interrupt the show or insult the performers. I think it's hilarious. I had a very, very realistic dream last night. Not about the patron, but it was... no one I knew, really. But it was realistic.
Well, how do you know it wasn't about the patron? You don't know what Caitlin looks like.
That's a good point.
It could
Maybe
literally
it
have been Caitlin. Yeah.
I'd be blushing if it were. But I will say, the realistic part of the dream is, usually my dreams are...
Well, you don't know Caitlin. She's, you know...
But usually my dreams...
Classic Caitlin.
When they're realistic, it's usually because visually, things look kind of real and audio and the scenario and stuff. But what was interesting last night is touch. My sense of touch.
Oh, that's weird, yeah.
I could really feel.
Yeah, that's weird.
And in a way that felt so that when I woke up, I'm like, damn, that was real.
Was your dog licking your crotch in real life or something? Like,
weird. No, no, no.
What sort of feels are we talking about?
No, and what I'm talking about, it wasn't, my hand could feel. My hand could feel, you know, velvet or...
Well, are you going to tell us what happened in the dream or not?
Oh, my God. Okay. So let me see. It's a dream, so it's weird and random. But, okay, I was at some sort of party or not. It's something. Okay, anyways, I'm sitting there and a gal walks by and she's attractive. And I say a funny thing, you know, just a quip of some sort. And she likes it, like reacts positively to it. So we start walking and she grabs my hand... holds it and cups herself with my hand. Like, and we're still
upstairs or downstairs?
Downstairs. And we're oh, yeah. And we're walking. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Front or back?
Front.
Wow.
And I'm not doing anything other than, oh, that's odd. Okay. We're walking. But it's now clear that she's very into me. And then I'm into her. She's, you know, very attractive. And so now we start like interacting and things like this. And then we show up at this other party. Now, when we're at this other party, there are other people. And now I think she's no longer paying attention to me. So I'm kind of disappointed by this. You're going to get a kick out of this. But then I'm like, well, that's okay. I need to go take a shower anyways. I don't know why. So I go to the bathroom to take a shower. And in the bathroom, I swear to God, I'm not making this up just from the podcast. You are there taking a shower along with two other dudes. You're not with the dudes, but there's like multiple showers. It's like a one of those like sports.
Did I grab your hand and cut me?
No.
Oh.
But you're taking a shower. The other two dudes are taking a shower. And I think there's another shower stall. So I start taking a shower. And you're like, Berto, or whatever. You know, like, yeah, I'm just taking a shower, whatever. But we're there. And then I go out of the shower.
How'd I look? Was I?
I only saw your back. You looked fine. You looked in good shape.
Okay.
You know, keeping up with the good shape Honda. I didn't see anyone's packages this time for some reason. But everyone was just kind of
this
facing.
This time,
yeah. But I come out of the shower, get out, and then now she's back interested in me for some reason. And now we're making out heavily. This is where my hands in my dream felt things very, very realistically.
Okay.
To the point where when I woke up, I was like, the fuck? Yeah. It was very odd.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Did your wife report any sort of groping in the middle of
that? Not yet. We'll see if tonight.
How's the dog doing?
Yeah, both the cat and the dog like to hang around. I myself felt a little. No, I don't know. Can you imagine?
Birdo, you did it. You did the classic.
All I know is
an inside joke that we have.
It felt very realistic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I feel like you should write that into Penthouse forums.
Yeah. But again, the realistic part that was unusual was the touching. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So, looking at your really great dream here, Caitlin. But to be clear, I enjoy when people come up to me. In fact, it happened when I was at a show. I was at an opera, actually. So for those that know the Shandy, Dear Shandy podcast, Charlene and Andy. Charlene used to be on The Bachelor not a while back, and I was on her podcast a while back. But anyway, she was in town performing this really great opera, and we met up with her, me and Stacy and Andy. And then she gave me tickets to see the opera, and it was amazing. And when I was at the opera, it was the first opera I ever seen. I mean, have you ever seen like a proper opera, like an yes. Italian opera?
Yeah. In fact, a lot, because first of all, when I was in high school, my mom would drag us along to Seattle and Tacoma operas frequently.
Oh.
Then later in life, she became a board member for the Tacoma Opera. So nowadays, not only do I have to, not have to, I love it now, but when I was a kid, but now I love it. Not only do we attend opera, but we attend functions where they're like fundraising and then some of the opera singers perform to, you know.
Yeah, it was amazing. And Charlene Joint is her name, is just incredible. She really stole the show. But anyway, at that show, a fan of the podcast came up to me. It was funny. So it was before the show began, and he must have seen me and Stacey come in, and we sit down. And
wait, where was it?
Macaw.
Oh, Macaw. Got it.
I think that's where the opera performs. Yeah. And so he comes around. So Stacey's in the aisle, and I'm right next to the aisle. And he says something in kind of a quiet voice. He says something, and I don't really hear what he's saying. And it's some sort of thank you. He's saying thank you. That's he says like a couple sentences, but I only hear thank you. I assume if some random person is coming up and thanking us, that it must be because Charlene gave us these tickets that are for the performers. In fact, our tickets said like performer section. It was in the front, you know, that sort of thing.
So they might think you're a performer.
Well, no, that they must be thanking us for supporting the performers or something. I don't know.
Oh, I see.
So I lean in And Stacy's kind of looking at me because she heard what he said. And I say something like, oh, you're thanking me for coming to the show? Like, I'm trying to give him a little bit of a break because he's talking quietly. And then Stacy looks at me like, no. And I'm, and there's a confused look on his face, and I'm thinking, what am I missing here? You know, like, what's happening? Confusion was that when I think of the quintessential listener to this podcast, I don't think of a man who's older than me.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Of course, there are some, but I would say it's got to be like less than 5% of the listenership or something. I have all the data, and there's a lot. The typical listener to the podcast is a woman in her 30s, essentially.
Got it.
Maybe early 40s or something like that. Not to say there aren't other people, obviously, but the point is that if it was a younger woman in her 30s,
you might connect the dots.
It would have been like a question, but you know, anyway.
Yeah, out of context, this happens to me all the time. Out of context stuff, it's so easy to get lost when it was perfectly obvious.
Yeah, it wasn't because I couldn't hear him. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I only heard thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, he leans in and repeats himself. He's like, thanks for the podcast. And, and so my point is that I absolutely enjoy running into fans in public, which doesn't happen all that often, to be honest. Maybe years from now, or if I was more famous, it would kind of annoy me eventually, but I don't know. You even hear from famous people, you know, Bradley Cooper, for example. And as long as you're nice about it, it, you know, it's nice to meet people that are fans of yours. You know what I mean?
It's only happened to me. Well, it's happened to me with strangers twice. And then in person, it's happened to me twice. Once in Seattle, once in New York, randomly. I mean, like, what the hell?
What was the Seattle one?
I was at Asajo with my friend Emil,
right.
And this gal comes up, excuse me, and I thought I was about to sit down, and I thought I was doing something wrong. I'm like, oh.
Didn't she just get you by your voice or something?
Yes, she heard me.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, Emil, whatever, and I was going to sit down. She's like, excuse me. I'm like, oh, and it's this gal, and she's like, are you from the Psychology in Seattle podcast? I'm like, yes, you know, it's really nice. Whereas the one in New York wasn't like, are you from, like, she was walking in, I was walking out, and she's like, oh my God, I love your podcast, right? It was like immediate, but bizarre, all the way in New York. And I've also been recognized by a relative, a friend of the family at a Christmas party. Not recognized, meaning like I found out that they know who I am, but I found out they listened to the podcast, which was really trippy. That was
That's really weird when that happens, because it changes a lot of things.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh, really?
Because, you know, before the podcast, when we would go to Thanksgiving or something, and there's extended family, you have a vague understanding of what they know about you.
Yeah.
And you probably have equal amounts of knowledge about each other. You know, as much as they know about your life, you probably know a similar amount about their life.
That's right.
And then you find out that they've been listening to the podcast, especially if they listen a lot. It's like a huge imbalance. They know so many things about you, and you still don't know very much about them.
Of course.
Anyway, for the record, everyone, in fact, if you do see me in public and we're not just passing on the street, I would appreciate it if you tell me you're in the room, because then I'll know not to pick my nose or something, you know what I mean? Because I worry about that sometimes. Like, so feel free to say whatever you want to. The other thing is that in your dream, Caitlin, you turn around and neither of us talked very much. That is what it would be like if we did run into each other in public. Generally speaking, I don't speak that often. I mean, I talk a lot with friends and with Stacy and Pete and others, but I'm not in public that kind of way. So you know, when people do come up to me, I generally ask a lot of questions, and I'm curious, you know, and I also figure, there's nothing that I'm going to tell this person that they don't already know, or they're not going to eventually know. So let's try to balance the scales a little bit.
Right.
So I'm mainly just want to know about you, and because I am genuinely curious, and that is usually how it happens. It's kind of interesting too, because some fans, when they come up to me or when we meet at some sort of function or something, you know, because the podcast has a lot of psychology and a lot of trauma talk, you know, people will tell me things, and I'm fine with that. There's nothing threatening to me.
Yeah.
I can navigate those conversations very easily, meaning that if I have to go, you know, then I have no problem right. telling someone while being caring in the same sentence, you know, so that'll happen sometimes. And I'm grateful for that too. Like when we had our very first live show,
yeah,
you know, fans flew in from out That's of town right. and from in town. And you could argue it's a similar kind of scenario yeah. where you're right. And that was one of the most euphoric experiences
Amazing.
Of our lives yeah, to, yeah. To after all these years to totally. Actually meet people.
Real human beings.
yeah. And also, if they've been listening, they must be like-minded, right?
Yeah.
So to meet people that can tolerate us, right. they must be similar or, you know, and that acceptance level and that, that,
Absolutely.
That, because, you know, right now we're talking to the microphones. We know eventually there'll be all these people listening, but it's an intangible thing.
Totally.
So when people come up to me anyway, I always enjoy it. And no one has ever bothered me. No one's ever talked my ear off. No one has ever yeah. imposed on me in any way.
I do have to say, if you see me in public, do not approach me. Well, okay, fine. Approach me. But like, don't...
What about cupping? Is that...
Okay, just don't request me to perform a song there on the spot. Okay, fine. I guess you could. Don't offer to buy me a drink. Well, okay, I'll buy you a drink.
So I there at one of our live events, I think maybe the first or second one, the after party was at this bar. And I, in my typical way, was just sitting with my wife and like a friend. And I just kind of want to unwind. And I'm not interested in talking a lot because I've expended all that, you know, with the live show. To my right is Umberto in the middle of a horseshoe of fans, and Berto is entertaining like 15 people loudly in this, and it's a public place, it's a bar. So
no, you didn't hear. They were like, "Stop talking!"
And I actually took a picture of it and some video. Maybe I'll include it here. I don't know. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that is it for that episode. Thanks. It's always fun to hang out with my best friend and answer your emails. There are a lot more emails, but we got to a good number of them.
Yeah.
And everyone out there, please take care of yourself and dream about whoever you want and whatever you want to dream. Because
and
it's
touch.
Just,
use your sense of touch.
It's just dreams.
And smell.
You know, there's no lawsuits in dreams because
you deserve it.